You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. It's been 10 years since Stockton filed bankruptcy, the largest municipality to do so at the time. Detroit would file bankruptcy the following year. During the 2008 recession, a perfect financial storm hit cities like Stockton hard. Foreclosures, declining home values, loose spending, and not planning for a negative downturn. Stockton is one of the most diverse cities in the country, yet is often used as a headline as poverty-stricken and a high-crime place. But headlines are just that, headlines, and there is, of course, more to the story. Michelle Wild Anderson is an urban law professor at Stanford University. Her new book, The Fight to Save the Town, documents the dismantling and rebuilding of local government in high-poverty communities. Professor Anderson helps us unpack what happened in Stockton and how residents are reinventing their city. Michelle, welcome to Insight. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. I'm so glad to be here, Vicky.
Happy to have you. When did you begin working on this book?
During the recession, so many local governments started to go broke. Stockton was just one of them, as you described it. And as that began happening across the country, I started learning about the weakness in our urban governments and just how many places had not only a emergency budget situation, but a multi-generational budget problem. So I started to see all of the places around the country that had this chronic decline problem.
In your book, you highlight four places that have their own unique characteristics, their own demographics, their own political views of the role of government, as well as their own financial challenges. There's Josephine County in Oregon, which is near the California border, Detroit, Lawrence, Massachusetts, near New Hampshire, and of course, Stockton. How are these places different and how are they the same?
Great. Yeah, the book focuses on places that are poor and also broke. And they're broke in part because they're poor, and they're poor in part because they're broke. So it's this sort of negative cycle that unites these places. But I also chose them in the book because they're so different from each other, as you described. So they're politically different from each other. They're racially different from each other. They run from very rural to big city urban. And in those differences, you really get a sense for the national problem and the way that a lot of different local histories can converge on this same kind of challenge.
Given that you titled the book, The Fight to Save the Town, Reimagining Discarded America, at what point in your research and in your journey did you come to this title?
Oh, that's such a lovely question. Early titles for the book were much more bleak. I won't say them out loud because they were really pretty bad. But at one point, I really decided that we don't have enough time for problem-focused writing anymore. There's just so much to do. And there are incredible people in cities like Stockton that are already working on these problems. And I wanted to write a book focused on them. I wanted them to be the experts and really to share the stories of progress that they're fighting so hard for. And I love that word fight because it is really hard work and the kind of resilience and tenacity it takes to encourage to show up for really difficult problems, you know, deserves a strong word like fight. So the title sort of emerged from a larger transformation to really focus not only on the underlying problems, but really on the people driving solutions.
Yeah, the word fight is definitely operative, but also what struck me was the word discarded, you know, to get rid of something that is no longer useful or desirable. What led to you choosing that specific word?
It's also such a good question. I like the word discarded because, like you say, it captures throwing something away. And I think a lot of these places, we want to just throw them away. We want to make them go away. And yet huge swaths of the country have this kind of problem. I mean, the American economy right now is spatially polarized, which is a wonky way of saying that we have these giant metro engines that are driving huge regional economies. And those big metro nodes of economic activity that we're all so familiar with in the Bay Area are places with lots of jobs, but not enough housing. So it's hard to make a living in that sense. But then there's even bigger areas of the country with a majority of our national population that have the opposite problem, not enough jobs and sometimes surplus housing, although costs are rising there too. And this word discarded to me captures that I think at some level we've had really since the end of the 80s, we've had this kind of willful blindness about this larger problem and really told ourselves this story that struggling places needed to pull themselves up by their bootstraps and figure it out. And these problems get worse when you leave them intergenerationally. Hmm. So I like the active sort of suggestion that we've not only sort of neglected these areas, we kind of tried to throw them away or push them out of our politics.
Stockton has a rich history that I think deserves a reminder, even just, you know, a first time lesson. What did you learn about the city's foundation and the early settlers that created such a diverse place?
You know, Stockton is the most diverse city in America. And I feel like we should just have a pregnant pause so all your listeners can just embrace that. I mean, that's an incredible
underlined
thing.
In bold and highlighted.
In bold. Get out your highlighter. I'm a teacher. Most diversity in America. I mean, that is magnificent. And to just describe what that means if you took a representative group of 20 people from Stockton, you'd have one Native American, 8 Latinx residents, 4 Asian Americans, 4 whites, 2 African Americans, and the one multiracial child of one of the highest rates of racial intermarriage in the country. I mean, that is a spectacular array of people. And the history that brought all of those people to Stockton is magnificent. It's this incredible story of California history, of global dislocation from war and various crises around the world. This incredible story of bravery and resilience, sort of making it to California. And then the history of the people that really helped build agriculture in California and really were the, you know, have been for generations some of the backbone of our food supply. And because the San Joaquin Valley, as your listeners know, is this critical breadbasket, not just for the Bay Area's food supply, but the world. You know, Stockton's people and the region's people have been so important to California ag. So this history is really inspiring. It's rooted in stories of Stockton's early commitment to freedom of religion that allowed a lot of different kinds of people to worship in the city. But, you know, that level of diversity has also had it's a tremendous challenge. And Stockton's history is stained by tremendous violence, by deep racial segregation, by a lot of racist conflict and exclusion. So it's a difficult history, but it's also a deeply American one that I think we have a lot to learn from.
How did your research and the conversations that you had for this book deepen your understanding of what ultimately led the city of Stockton to file for bankruptcy a decade ago?
Yeah, that's great. So, you know, on the surface, so many of your listeners know that the surface story of Stockton's bankruptcy was the foreclosure crisis and just getting slammed by the recession itself. And that's true. Stockton got slammed by the recession and the foreclosure crisis took a terrible toll on families there. But that recession came as a shock to a city that already had this much deeper intergenerational problem of tremendous racial segregation and very concentrated poverty in parts of the city, sort of behind those racially segregated lines. And the crack epidemic that had raged in so many cities in America, including Stockton, led to peak levels of violence in the early 90s. And those, that's sort of peak homicide rates nationwide. And Stockton at that, you know, in that era, Stockton at that time had, you know, really took this crisis so hard. And there were a whole generation of kids that were victims and witnesses to that crisis, a whole generation of neighborhoods that were really traumatized by that drug crisis. And I think for, you know, Stockton, like many cities, answered that crisis primarily with incarceration. And so you got a generation of kids that were also orphaned by the loss of fathers to incarceration or the loss of loved ones to homicide or to drugs. And that larger problem, I think, in many cities, including Stockton, was never ministered to in a loving way. It was, there was just a kind of hit harder sort of answer to that crisis. Anyway, fast forward, and you know, those, the children of that crisis are in their 20s. And I think there's just this breathtaking social movement in Stockton to really care for current children, to care for youth in the city, to care for parents who are trying to be better parents than they had, and really sort of take care of the underlying scar tissue and trauma that have come with concentrated violence over so many years.
You know, when talking about violence and crime and incarceration and also just the financial woes of this city, I mean, those often make headlines. I'm just curious, what impact does this narrative have on a society, as you're describing, going through trauma and what could arguably be called destructive journalism?
You know, that the narrative is so important. I think we can throw that word around as though it's just sort of the way we talk, but it's actually really destructive when we tell stories that cities like Stockton are, quote unquote, the most miserable place to live, or, you know, corrupt politicians and bullets flying and, you know, broken people and so forth. These kinds of stories really build up as a form of hopelessness and despair in local politics, and also just in families and kids of sort of, what do I have to expect for my future? You know, what is this place where I live? And, you know, in the book, I tell some more private stories of what that's like to grow up as a kid in a place that the world is constantly ragging on and, you know, putting down. And the incredible thing about the social movement that I wrote about in Stockton is that people are really rebuilding and deepening these networks of people who look out for each other, this sort of ferocious loyalty and friendship and fun sometimes, you know, just really working together to sort of make a place a community and help rebuild some of that damage. And you watch how these vicious cycles of hopelessness start to shift toward a more virtuous cycle of accomplishments, like one little thing at a time. And then 5 years later, you've got quite a list and some real relationships of people who are used to leaning on each other, cooperating, working together. And you just start to see a lot of positive momentum. And I think in the 2016 to 2020 period, which is mostly what I focus on in the book, Stockton had a lot of really incredible momentum that way.
Yeah, we're talking about the perception versus the reality and the progress that's being made. What strikes you about this movement from residents who are very passionate about their community and the effect that they're having on potentially local government and the decisions they make, especially when it comes to investing in the city and underserved and neglected parts of the city?
There has been there really important progress in some of the poorest neighborhoods in the city. But it's interesting, this word impact, you know, effect, impact, these are really important words to focus on in local politics, because, you know, so much of local politics tries to deliver a quick return, right? Like, oh, we can redevelop a new movie theater and we can cut a ribbon on the new movie theater and we can all take a picture of that and feel great about the progress that's being had. It's much harder to see instant returns on anti-trauma work or on really on caregiving for families after long-term violence. And so, you know, you're not going to get, you know, photogenic moments of great kind of impact that happen quickly. And that was something, you know, it's so beautiful to spend time with the residents of Stockton who are really involved in this work, because they understand that a lot of their work is not going to, you know, it's seeds that are being planted for the long term and for the future of the city. Michael Tubbs, when he was mayor, he was a really important and I think incredibly effective mayor in Stockton. And he really tried to focus a lot of his administration on getting the rates of trauma in the city down, of really focusing on healing and mental health services for individuals and families. And, you know, you're just not going to see a lot of splashy immediate stats from that kind of investment, but it is it's what has to happen if you're serious about intergenerational poverty. There's no shortcuts that allow us to you know, just will that problem away.
Yeah. And Stockton isn't alone in this. There are places across the country that face similar issues of poverty. What lessons do you think local governments can learn from places like Stockton in how, if they're overcoming perhaps mismanagement and maybe even redefining what a priority is to them?
Yeah, well, here I just want to invite folks to picture this mayoral conference room in Lawrence, Massachusetts, this amazing little town, also totally pathologized in its region. If you're in Boston, you think of Lawrence, Massachusetts as, you know, this incredibly poor city, mismanaged, very violent. Former President Trump often referred to it as the cause or the driver for the opioid crisis. So it's constantly sort of in that region for bad news. And yet there's amazing people in Lawrence doing such good work. And in the mayoral conference room, former Mayor Dan Rivera had this whiteboard, and on the whiteboard, he had written a message to himself and his staff to just remind himself of sort of what they were doing every single day. And he said at the top, the message said, "Do something. Can we do it today?" It said that in blue. And then in red, it said, "Stop explaining the problem, start explaining the solution." And at the bottom, his wife had written in green, "Keep your head up." And I thought that kind of summarized a lot of the work in Stockton too, a lot of the good work that has to happen everywhere, which is like, just do something. There's all kinds of things that local governments cannot control, the opioid crisis being one, things that are just giant forces that are beyond a local government's realm of authority. But people can sort of wrap their arms around their neighbors, their neighborhood, specific programs, really getting involved in their community. And that's, you know, you have to have a ground game like that. You can't simply solve big public policy problems from the top down. There has to constantly be a healthy synergy of activism at all levels of government. So I loved Dan Rivera's message that way of sort of, we just have to keep going. We just have to keep doing things. And Stockton has had, you know, really a generation of people that have showed up for that work in ways that I find just deeply moving.
Yeah. As you mentioned, planting seeds as opposed to, you know, that the ribbon cutting ceremonies and making that true difference. Michelle, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. I'm so glad to be here.
Michelle Wild Anderson is an urban law professor at Stanford University, discussing her new book, The Fight to Save the Town, and how cities like Stockton have been discarded in today's modern economy. Still ahead, a Tony Award-winning musical takes the stage. The Woodland Opera House joins us about opening its season with In the Heights. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.